This is Healthy Rounds with Dr. Anthony Alessi. Sponsored by Hartford Healthcare, Rochford Eye Center, St. Francis Hospital, Covaris, and Yukon Health Orthopedics and Sports Medicine. Healthy Rounds provides general information regarding medical conditions and diseases. The information is not intended to create a doctor-patient relationship. You're encouraged to consult your own medical provider for advice that applies to your own medical care. And now, Dr. Anthony Alessi on WTIC, News Talk 1080 and WTIC.com.
Welcome to Healthy Rounds, the show that provides you with up-to-date medical information, and we answer all of your health questions. I'm your host, Dr. Anthony Alessi, and it's great to be with you on this sunny Saturday morning, October 11th, 2025. And as many of you know, October has been designated as Breast Cancer Awareness Month, and it has been for a period of time. And the field of breast cancer has been one of great interest to many listeners on our program since it affects so many people. And we've made so much progress in the treatment of breast cancer. So my guest today is going to be Dr. Niamey Wilson. Dr. Wilson is a breast surgery, she's head of the breast surgery division, and Director of Breast Surgery Research and Quality at Hartford Healthcare. So she's going to be spending some time with us today. She's been on our program before. And we're going to talk about breast cancer and particularly try to clear up some of the confusion about when women should be getting the mammograms, what you should do. I like the idea of prevention. So what can we do to head things off and really work with that and move in the right direction? So we'll be with Dr. Wilson in the second segment of our program and go right till the end. So if you have questions for Dr. Wilson about breast cancer, you can reach us at info@alessimd.com, and I'm happy to ask her questions live for you on the air. This week, several things came up. Now, we talked a little bit about the COVID recommendations or non-recommendations from the CDC and the Advisory Council on Immunization Practices. Basically, they concluded that with respect to COVID, you should talk to your doctor. That was their final recommendation as to who should get the COVID vaccination. So there was really no recommendation, and I agree with them. Talk to your doctor. I do also want to say that I did get my vaccinations this week for both COVID and influenza, and I got them both at the same time. I got them both in the same arm, and I felt fine. I was able to go back to work. I was able to work the next day and the day after that and not feel any ill effects. So I urge people to talk to your doctor if there's anything, if it's a question. But certainly if you're over 65 and if you have any underlying conditions, please get the vaccination to really stay out of the hospital. That's the object here. You may still get COVID. You may still get a little bit of the flu, but you won't end up back in the hospital. And that's what we're trying to avoid. Also, I was able to see a documentary on Dr. Jane Goodall, and it was called Famous Last Words. I highly recommend it. It was on Netflix. And this is a program that was taped before her death with the understanding that it would not be shown until after she passed away. So it was almost as if Dr. Goodall would be speaking to us from the beyond and messages that she wanted us to have. And it was fascinating. There were no camera people in the room. Everything was automated. It was just she and an interviewer. And for the last segment, the interviewer left. So it was a little eerie, to say the least, but so instructive as to what you would want to say when there's no recriminations for what you say, and share with the world what you have learned through your lifetime. So anyhow, I recommend that as much as possible. This day in medicine, October 11th, 1593. So this is roughly 100 years after the discovery of the United States. Dr. Nicholas Tulip was born. Dr. Tulip was a Dutch physician and an anatomist who described beriberi. And it's interesting because when we think of something like beriberi, we don't really think about it affecting us today. But beriberi is just another name for a vitamin B1 deficiency or thiamine deficiency, which is something we still see throughout the world today, including the United States. In fact, it's not that uncommon. And the reason is because you see it in alcoholics. So people who are addicted to alcohol will often not absorb thiamine or have an adequate diet. And when they develop this thiamine deficiency, they will have neurologic symptoms. Typically, they have problems with eye gaze and eye movements, but more importantly, they develop a syndrome of dementia and memory that is reversible with the use of thiamine intravenously and intramuscularly. So beriberi first reported back in probably in the 1600s is something that we still see today. So I love when we get to topics such as that. You know, we're hearing a lot about, in case you haven't noticed, the government's shutdown. Our government has come to a complete halt, and we're now being faced with people not getting paid, things just not getting done. So the key issue here as to why the government is shut down revolves around the Affordable Care Act. So I thought it would be a good time to review what that is. And basically, its formal name is the Patient Protection and Affordable Care Act. It was first passed into law, so it is a law. It was passed into law in March 2010. So we've had this for 15 years. Currently, the insurance portion of this, the Affordable Care Act itself, the cooperative for buying insurance, affects approximately 22 million people in the United States. And it affects people in all states. So it is something that affects many people. And basically, it is a comprehensive health care reform law. It was a way of trying to change what has been a terribly inefficient system in the United States. And for the most part, in the past 15 years, the system has worked. At least it's worked for 22 million people who would otherwise not have health insurance. And it's gone by a lot of, so it's called the ACA, and it was dubbed Obamacare in the past. So this is all the same program. And basically, it was designed for people who work for a living, make money, but they don't make enough money to buy insurance, and they are either self-employed or they have an employer that does not provide insurance. And that could be many types of small businesses, but it's especially true of people who want to go out and do something different. You know, I hate when we stifle creativity. So much in the United States has come from our creative juices, okay, our ability to go out, start a new business, bring a new idea to the public. So a lot of times when you go out and start your business, Steve Jobs working in his garage or any other people, you can't afford health insurance. So this made it affordable for many people. Let me explain a little bit how it works. So it makes affordable health care insurance available for people who are at the lower end of the income spectrum. So basically, it's for lower costs for household incomes that are in a certain range of the federal poverty level. the federal poverty level, and I had to look this up, the federal poverty level in 2025 for an individual is $15,650. If you make less than that, you qualify of being below the poverty level. For a family of four, the poverty level is $32,150. Now, there are people who make more than that, but still can't afford insurance. So there's a scale for which the federal government will provide what are called premium tax credits. That means that the federal government will contribute to this plan for up to 50% of the premium. Taking it down to basics, if you're in this group that qualifies for the Affordable Care Act, and say you're paying $1,000 a month for your insurance, that's what it costs. The cost is $1,000 a month for you to get Blue Cross insurance or Blue Shield insurance. The federal government will contribute half of that. So $500 a month would be contributed by the federal government so that you only had to pay the $500 and still get health insurance so that when you went to your doctor, right, you can go to the doctor and the bills would be paid. Or you go to the hospital, the bills would get paid by the insurer. That's how it basically works. The problem here is on December 31st, the premium tax credits go away. Why do they go away? Because there's a Trump bill, and I know they want to call it a beautiful bill, but we haven't found anything beautiful about it. It eliminates these tax credits on December 31st. That's going to happen unless we take some action. Unless Congress takes some action, many people are going to be without their insurance. And this bill was there to support innovative methods. The electronic health record was, again, part of what came out of the Affordable Care Act. Protecting your privacy came out of the Affordable Care Act. But the other thing, and most recently this week, we've heard from Marjorie Taylor Greene. And Marjorie Taylor Greene has told us she's upset because her children will have to pay 50 or 100% more for their health insurance. The reason it affects young people is after age 26, you are not eligible to be on your parents' insurance plan any longer. Therefore, based on your income, if you're just starting out in business or starting out as an employee, you would go into the pool, the cooperative, through the Affordable Care Act to buy insurance. So people know already how much their insurance is going to go up based on the fact that these subsidies are going to go away. That's why the system, our government, is shut down. Now, the other misnomer is that people who are here illegally are receiving federal aid. They're getting Affordable Care Act money. They're getting Medicare. They're getting Medicaid. I can tell you that that's a lie. Whoever tells you that is either intentionally telling you a lie or they're uninformed. And I know that because I have firsthand information. I am one of the physicians in the state of Connecticut who approves people for health benefits through Medicaid. And I can tell you, I review the entire record, and in that record, these people have to have a Social Security number, and they have to be here legally to qualify for Medicaid to get these benefits. That is a fact. So let's not get people confused by making them think people are running across some border, coming here, and getting all their health benefits. Now, on the other side of that is, if people are in this country, no matter who they are, and they need emergency care through a law called EMTALA, the Emergency Medical Treatment and Labor Act, if they come to an emergency room, that hospital is obliged to treat that person. They could be a visitor from another country here to see their children or family, or they could be someone here without documentation. We have to treat them. And that hospital needs to be paid, and they're paid through the government. So that system needs to be looked at and rectified. With that, I hope this has become a little more clear for everybody as we go through this government shutdown. We're going to take a short break. If you want to reach out to me for questions from my guest, Dr. Niamey Wilson, you could reach out at info@alessimd.com. You're listening to Healthy Rounds on WTIC News Talk 1080. We're back on Healthy Rounds. I'm your host, Dr. Anthony Alessi, and it's great to have as my guest today, Dr. Niamey Wilson. Dr. Wilson is a surgeon at Hartford Healthcare. She specializes in breast care and breast surgery. She is the breast surgery division leader at Hartford Healthcare and director of breast surgery research and quality. Niamey, welcome back to the show.
Thanks for having me, Tony.
So let's chat a little bit. I mean, a lot seems to be changing in the field of breast cancer and breast treatment. And let's talk, I mean, you're a breast surgeon, and can you talk to our listeners a little bit about what your training has been like to get to where you are today?
Yes, absolutely. So, yes, I'm a breast surgeon, which means that I did my initial training in general surgery. There is no specific training for only doing breast surgery. So I'm a board certified general surgeon. I have my certification in general surgery. And for me, that was a 7-year program. I trained at Penn. And then we typically do a 1-year fellowship in surgical oncology just about breast. So it's 1 year basically learning surgical techniques. We go through all of the fields that take care of breast cancer patients, so radiation oncology, medical oncology, plastic surgery, radiology, genetics. There's obviously a wide variety of fields that take care of a breast cancer patient. So in that year, not only are you learning the advanced surgical techniques, you're also experiencing the full multidisciplinary approach.
So let's just talk about breast cancer in general. I mean, and really where you work. What constitutes a breast center?
A breast center can have different levels depending on what they offer at each location. So at Hartford Healthcare, we have a number of breast centers across the state, and typically they will include providers such as the breast surgeons, and we have a fantastic group of what are called mid-level providers, so our PAs and APRNs who also see our patients. And then a lot of times we have a radiology group that works very closely with us that may be on site or at least, close by in terms of proximity. And then there's also other divisions that may have services at that location as well. So I can give you, for example, at Mid-State, which is where I primarily practice, we have our medical oncologist, radiation oncologist, radiologist, pathologist, and we do the surgeries, of course, at Mid-State. So for the most part, we would call that a comprehensive center because we offer all of the services provided that a breast cancer patient would need.
You know, I've only got like 1 minute before the break, and I want to get rid of some misbelief out there. And that is, and I recently had this situation in the last year or so, I had a friend call me and she said, you know, I have a breast lump, but it's painful, so I know it can't be cancer. And I said, you need to get to a doctor now. And it ended up being cancer. Can we get rid of that idea? Well, how did that all come about that if you have a painful lump, it can't be cancer?
Yeah, that's definitely a misconception. In general, most breast cancers are not painful. So that is true. The majority of them are a painless lump, but there are absolutely a number of patients who we see who have a painful lump and it turns out to be cancer. You cannot ignore pain. Typically, pain is, thankfully, generally benign from a benign condition. But if somebody has a painful lump or just even pain in general, it really needs to be evaluated.
Great. I wanted to get that out. We're going to take a short break. Now we're going to be back with my guest, Dr. Nia Mae Wilson. We're going to really delve into breast cancer. What are the current treatments? And what are the things you need to do to be able to really diagnose it early in yourself? So you could reach out at info@alessimd.com. You're listening to Healthy Rounds on WTIC News Talk 1080. We're back on Healthy Rounds. I'm your host, Dr. Anthony Alessi, and it's great to have as my guest today, Dr. Nia Mae Wilson. Dr. Wilson is the director of the breast program at Hartford Hospital. If you wish to reach out to her at her facility, the telephone number is area code 203-694-5200. Nia Mae, just at the break, we talked a little bit about painful lesions and a little bit about the differential diagnosis. I mean, when you feel a lump, are you often thinking right away breast cancer or possibly infection or a cyst? I mean, is that the basic differential when you feel a lump?
Yeah, I think obviously cancer is the most important thing to rule out. So that has to be the highest priority. But certainly most palpable lumps are not cancer. So, you know, after you rule that out, then it could be a variety of different things. There are the most common lump in the breast is something called a fibroadenoma, which are benign growths. They don't contribute to increased risk. And they're usually, we're able to leave them alone if they're not causing problems for the patient. There can be cysts. There can be just hormonal changes in the tissue. Some diabetic patients get very cystic tissue. There can be infection, of course, but usually with infection, you would see redness. The patient would have more pain, you know, fevers, that kind of thing, potentially. So infection would be something that comes along with other symptoms for sure.
Let's talk a little bit about breast cancer. Are we winning the battle? I mean, we've been talking about breast cancer over the last at least 50 years, okay? Are we making headway?
Yes. I mean, I don't, you know, it's very common, unfortunately. Breast cancer is one of the most common cancers for women. It's second only to skin cancer. So it will affect basically one in every eight women in their lifetime. So it's a very, very common cancer. But the risk of dying from breast cancer has dropped significantly since the 80s. So although it is still very common to be diagnosed with breast cancer, the treatment for it and the outcomes are so much better, and they just continue to get better over time. So it's definitely a much improved prognosis from what we had, but it is still very common, and the rates do seem to be sort of slowly creeping up. And there's not a very clear answer why, but there are some hypotheses. But it is generally more treatable these days, for sure.
Are we still thinking a lot has to do with genetics as opposed to environmental causes?
Only about 5 to 10% of our breast cancer patients have a genetic condition, at least one that we can detect now. You know, our genetic testing is very good. It's very accurate. Could there be something else in our bodies that we're not able to, you know, measure at the moment because it's October of 2025 and not, you know, the year 2500? Potentially. So we don't know for sure at this point why the other patients get their breast cancers, but about 5 to 10% are really due to a genetic mutation that we can detect.
What are the types of breast cancer?
There's really two varieties. There's what's called non-invasive breast cancer and invasive breast cancer. Non-invasive breast cancer, which is also known as DCIS, standing for ductal carcinoma in situ, is when there are cancer cells, but they are all still trapped inside the milk ducts. And we do call that a cancer, but it's very early stage. It's actually stage zero. And extremely treatable, has nearly a, you know, almost 100% survival rate. But then there's invasive breast cancer. Invasive breast cancer is broken into two things, invasive ductal carcinoma and invasive lobular carcinoma. And that's just based on the anatomy of where the cancer cells originated, whether it was from the lobule or the duct. And those are two parts of the milk duct, or the milk gland, I should say. And invasive, the word invasive means that the cells have broken out of either the duct or the lobule and gone into the tissue. That word does not mean it's spread all over their body. It just means that the cells have broken out of the duct or the lobule.
At what point then, after that, so we now have invasion into the breast. How often do we see it where it's gone outside the breast? In terms of on a primary diagnosis. Here's what I'm getting at. I'm getting at the idea that we now have better ways of diagnosing cancer and breast cancer. So is it less often that when we first find out about it, it has already spread to other organs?
Oh, yes. It's much more often that when we diagnose breast cancer, it's still what's considered localized or even regional. Localized means that it's in the breast, just confined to the breast. Regional means that it's also in the lymph nodes, but it has not gone outside of that. Then there's distant metastasis, which is when the cancer has spread to other organs. And thankfully, that's only about 5 to 6% of our patients who are diagnosed at the time of diagnosis. So the vast majority are confined to the breast and or lymph nodes in the armpit at the time of diagnosis.
If in looking at this, in looking at breast cancer in general, we're always hearing about younger people being affected by younger women. Can you talk a little bit about that? Is it just that we're diagnosing it earlier, or is it appearing in younger women?
Yeah, it does seem to be appearing in younger women these days, and there's not a very clear-cut answer as to why, but there are some thoughts. One potential reason is that, as you said, we are getting better at detecting cancer. Basically, every mammography unit across the state at this point is most likely a 3D mammogram unit, and 3D mammograms are able to detect very small changes in the tissue better than the standard 2D mammogram units could, which means that we can find very, very subtle changes or just a couple little dots of calcifications that we might not have been able to see with prior mammograms. So we might be able to be diagnosing some of these cancers earlier. The other thing is that people are living longer and doing better. And so as you age, you are more likely to get diagnosed with cancer. So it is also possible that just, you know, that's kind of artificially elevating the overall numbers. So in terms of younger patients, though, there's a variety of reasons that have been proposed in terms of, you know, early detection, potentially these some changes in reproductive issues, like people choosing to have children later in life. There's definitely an increase in obesity in this country that could contribute, and other factors like environmental changes and what's in our food and lack of exercise, those probably all contribute.
I have a question for you from Stacy. She is a breast cancer survivor who had a mastectomy and reconstruction, and she wanted to know how common is it now for women to have reconstruction at the time of surgery?
Most women should be offered reconstruction at the time of mastectomy unless there's a really clear indication not to do that. So in general, there are certain cases where we do what's called delayed reconstruction, and that is where the patient has to undergo the mastectomy in order to avoid any potential increase in complications. The mastectomy is performed so that the patient can then get on with their additional treatment, you know, including chemotherapy or radiation. Reconstruction is considered elective, and so it does potentially add an increased risk of complications. So we don't want to take that risk in somebody who's got a more significant cancer. But in general, those are patients who, you know, for the most part, patients should be offered same-day reconstruction. So I would say it's probably somewhere in the 50 to 75% range of patients who undergo immediate reconstruction, and maybe higher than that at certain locations.
When did that become so common? I guess I've been out of the loop when it comes to this. I didn't realize it was that common.
To have reconstruction, you mean?
Yeah. In other words, to 50 to 70. I mean, yeah. When did that change? In the last 10 years or longer?
Yeah, probably in the last 15 to 20 years or so, reconstruction has become a really important part of the treatment. You know, women don't want to look deformed. They don't want to be missing a breast. Now, some women choose to go flat, and that is a big movement. It's called, you know, going flat. Aesthetic flat closure is something we offer as well. You don't really need to have breasts, certainly after, you know, breastfeeding is complete. They do cause problems as you get older. But reconstruction is important, and we owe it to everybody to offer that if we can. Again, some patients are not good candidates for it because of either the type of cancer they have. They may be very unhealthy in terms of, you know, their diabetes is out of control, and so complications might be too risky for certain patients. But in general, we try to offer reconstruction as often as we can because if it's important to the woman, then it's important to us.
Do you do the reconstruction, or does plastic surgery come in as part of the team to do it? How do you plan all that?
Yeah, it's a joint surgery. So okay. It's myself as the breast surgeon, and then the plastic surgeon is right there in the room, and they are able to do the reconstruction as soon as the mastectomy portion is done.
All right, let's move on. I want to get a little bit back into the weeds, a little bit about self-examination. And, you know, there have been published reports really talking about how self-examination does not help in terms of increasing survival from breast cancer. Can you talk a little bit about, because that was the main thing we taught women for the past 40 or 50 years is self-examination. Can you talk a little bit about self-examination?
Yeah, so, you know, breast self-exam, I still think this is important. A lot of people still do, and I'll tell you why. It is true that if a woman examines herself very thoroughly, you know, once a month, they're going to find lumps. Breast tissue is lumpy. It's not smooth sheets of tissue on the inside. It's lumps of fat and lumps of breast parenchyma. So they're going to find lumps. The real question is, are any of them new, and is something changing? So what I tell my patients is not to go hunting for lumps because they're going to find them. But what I want my patients to do is have what's called breast self-awareness. So they should know what their tissue feels like and periodically assess themselves, you know, whether it's every other month or whatever the time frame is. I mean, usually I tell people every other month is sufficient, and it should be an exam to the point where you just know if something is new or is changing or is different. You're going to find lumps because that's the nature of breast tissue, but the real thing is to be aware of if you're finding a change.
So naturally, that's going to lead us to the next step, and that is mammogram and the recommendations for mammography, which has been a moving target. Based on the guidelines as to what age should they start at age 50, age 45, age 40. What's your take on this?
Most of the guidelines that are put out by the physician societies like the American College of Radiology, the American Society of Breast Surgery, American College of Obstetrics and Gynecology, we've always said 40 should be the start date for when you start getting annual mammograms. The USPSTF, the United Services Preventive Services Task Force, had a recommendation starting at age 50 and getting a mammogram every other year. So they were a little bit more hands-off when it came to that. And more recently, because of this slight shift in earlier diagnosis, they've changed their recommendation now to start at 40. And they still say every 2 years. Again, most of the other societies still recommend annually starting at 40, but at least now we all agree that we should start at 40. The interesting thing is when to stop. The data doesn't support doing mammograms after age 74, but really what we tell people is do a mammogram if you're still in good health and you'd be willing to act on the result. You know, if you're very unhealthy and you're not doing well, there's no reason to get a mammogram if you're 85 years old. But if you're doing well and you're active and you can take care of yourself and, you know, undergo usually a pretty minor operation, then I think it's absolutely fine to continue getting mammograms.
I'm really glad you mentioned that because I don't think that's something we think of very often. How often do you see breast cancers in women over the age of 74?
It's actually a pretty good number. You know, our typical age is more in the 60s, but we have absolutely patients who are diagnosed in their late 70s, 80s, even 90s. But thankfully, those patients tend to have much slower growing cancers. And, you know, there is this potential risk of overdiagnosis if someone gets really elderly. You don't want to be doing a, you know, major surgery on a 95-year-old
sure.
who has a breast cancer that will never be clinically relevant in her lifetime. So there's a balance there for sure.
You know, I think it really impresses the importance for people to see a doctor and not just go by you know, everybody loves to go by protocol, right? And protocol, just explain that to a patient. That's for research, okay? I mean, everybody has to be treated the same exact way. But every patient is an individual, and you have individual needs, and it's so important. And so I'm glad you brought that up, Niamey, because that's important to have that frank conversation with your physician as to whether you want to be treated or not. And get advice. But I want to move on a little bit. Other than mammogram, right, I always hear, okay, I had a positive mammogram, now I have to go for an ultrasound or an MRI. Can you explain when those tests kind of come into the picture after the mammogram?
Absolutely. So for women who have dense tissue, so let's say somebody has a routine screening mammogram and they're told they have dense tissue. I feel like a lot of people think this is just some sort of black box and they don't understand it. Density is just the balance between how much glandular tissue you have and how much fat you have. It's a mammographic finding. It's not a clinical exam finding. You can't do an exam and say, oh, you have dense tissue. That's not how it works. It is based on the mammogram. And on a mammogram, breast tissue is white and fat is black. And so the radiologist looks at it and assigns it a category of density, whether it's very fatty, mildly fatty, or what's called scattered density. And then there's into the balance of dense. And so there's heterogeneously dense and extremely dense. And so essentially, for somebody who has dense tissue, all that means is that they don't have a lot of fat in their breast. And the mammogram is a little bit more tricky to evaluate because it looks like there's tissue kind of overlapping on itself, and it's a little bit more challenging to detect a small lump that could be hiding inside the white stuff on the mammogram. So for somebody who has dense tissue, we typically recommend a screening ultrasound as well. Screening ultrasounds absolutely can find small masses that turn out to be cancers, and so we routinely recommend them. They have never been shown to make you live longer. So whereas mammography has actually been shown to improve your survival from a diagnosis of breast cancer, ultrasound has never done that. But it still can detect small cancers that require less treatment. So in the state of Connecticut, for sure, we recommend a screening ultrasound for anybody who has dense tissue. MRIs are different. MRIs are a much more thorough exam, but it's a vascular-based test, and it's considered invasive because you do get an IV and you get contrast during the MRI. But what the MRI is doing is essentially, as you're going through the unit, contrast starts circulating around, and the contrast leaks out into the tissue in certain areas. So it could be cancer, but there are absolutely benign changes in the tissue where the contrast can leak out. But it's looking for vascular-based tests. So it's a dynamic study. It's not just a one-time picture. I think the MRIs typically take about 4,000 images. So it's a totally different test, and we really reserve that for women who either have a genetic mutation and we need to screen them much more carefully, or if there's some indeterminate area and the mammogram and ultrasound are not giving us the answers that we need. And sometimes if a patient is newly diagnosed with certain types of cancers, we use the MRI to evaluate the tissue a little bit more carefully.
Let's move on, because I find it interesting that we've got the diagnosis. We've talked a lot about surgery and reconstruction, but What are the other treatments? At what point do women require chemotherapy, radiation therapy, and really, you know, what types of treatment we're using now?
Sure. So in general, I kind of tell my patients that there's two categories of treatment. There's local treatment, and that is a combination of typically surgery and radiation, and that can control the local disease that's in the breast and the armpit. Then there's systemic disease and systemic treatment, and so that is for the potential chance that a microscopic cell has escaped and is kind of out there somewhere in the body and needs to be targeted. And for that, we use chemotherapy and oral medication. For the chemotherapy question, it's very tailored. So every patient who is recommended for chemotherapy, they typically are, they either have a specific type of breast cancer, such as triple negative breast cancer or HER2 positive breast cancer. Those are kind of features of the cancer that we look for. Or they have a genetic test based on their cancer that would indicate that they have a good, they're going to have a good response to chemotherapy and they need it. So it is a very tailored decision. It's definitely not the case that all patients with invasive cancer need chemotherapy. In terms of radiation, radiation is given typically after a woman only has a portion of the breast tissue removed as opposed to the entire breast. And so the radiation is given afterwards to lower the chance that the cancer could grow back in that breast.
I always forget this. If you have the positive receptors, the HER2 positive, is that a better prognosis than being HER2 negative?
Well, there's HR and then there's HER2, and it gets
okay.
A little...
Now you're confusing me, but
yeah. So there's three receptors that we look at for basically all breast cancers, except for DCIS, which we only look at right. One. But in invasive cancers, we look at the estrogen receptor, the progesterone receptor, and HER2. HER2 is its own thing. It's almost I kind of describe it as like a growth factor. But estrogen and progesterone. It is usually a better prognosis if those are positive, meaning the cancer cells have that receptor.
Okay.
HER2 is a sign typically of a more aggressive cancer, and almost all of those patients will need chemotherapy. However, there are extremely effective targeted therapies now for HER2 positive cancers that those patients actually do very well when they get those targeted therapies.
We don't have much time, and I want to get to a couple other things. A patient of mine this week, I told her we were doing this show, and she asked that you talk a little bit about the after effects after going through surgery, radiation, chemotherapy, and kind of the psychological and other effects. And she mentioned a group called the Breasties. Can you talk a little bit about this aftercare?
Yeah, it is a challenge for a lot of our patients because, you know, they get diagnosed, they hurry through surgery, they hurry through radiation. Chemotherapy is, you know, toxic stuff and really takes it out of people. And then they kind of cross over to this other side where they're now just being monitored. And it's kind of confusing for patients, honestly. And they get a little scared and they don't know if, like, you know, what state they're in, because they don't know if the cancer is going to come back, but yet they're not in active treatment anymore. A lot of them are on oral medication, so they know that they're being given something that's kind of helping their cancer diagnosis. But after active treatment, you know, there's kind of this expectation, like, okay, you can go back to your normal life now. And for a lot of women, that's really hard because it's always in the back of their mind, is the cancer going to come back? If I, you know, they stub their toe and they're like, oh God, it's the cancer. You know, it's always in the back of their mind. So it's really important to talk about the fact that we have a ton of support groups. We have an amazing network of nurse navigators who put people in touch with the support groups that are in their area. There's a ton of online support groups, obviously. And then, you know, during the month of October, for example, we have a ton of walks and groups, and there's yoga for cancer survivors where you can meet lots of people. There's so many different networks where patients can talk to one another and survivors can talk to one another, because getting it off your chest and getting and talking about it is a huge part of the therapy of how to deal with the after effects of being diagnosed with breast cancer.
I got 1 minute left, but I wanted to get to this one. What's the next innovation our listeners need to know about in breast cancer?
So what I really wanted to kind of make sure the listeners knew was that there is something called circulating tumor DNA, which is basically, is going to be the next forefront in our cancer world. What this is a blood test that can detect if you have circulating cancer cells in your bloodstream. And so the idea is that this could detect a cancer recurrence or a new cancer way earlier than any sort of imaging test could. This is what's being talked about at all the cancer conferences and organizations, and there are tests that are available, but the question is, what do you do with the result? So right now, it's only being used in very, very specific situations. It is not for mass consumption yet. There are active protocols being worked out to try to figure out what to do with this information.
Niamh, thank you. Thank you for everything you do for our community, and thank you for spending time with us today. If you wish to reach out to Dr. Wilson, it's 203-694-5200. Many thanks to Kevin Corza, who's been on the board today. Next week on Healthy Rounds, we're going to be talking about migraine headaches with Dr. Tanya Bilchik. Until next week, this is Dr. Anthony Alessi. Please stay healthy.
This has been Healthy Rounds with Dr. Anthony Alessi, sponsored by Hartford HealthCare, Rachford Eye Center, St. Francis Hospital, Covaris, and UConn Health Orthopedics and Sports Medicine. Be sure to tune in next Saturday morning at 11 for more Healthy Rounds on WTIC News Talk 1080 and WTIC.com. Till then, stay well.